Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Melinda St. Louis of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, who discusses the campaign now being waged to stop a lame duck session vote on the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Deal. Rana Epting of the group Every Voice, who summarizes the demand by 30 democracy reform groups that the moderator in the first presidential candidate debate focused the discussion on restoring faith in democratic institutions. And seven-time Grammy-winning saxophonist and composer Paul Winter, who talks about his new composition, All My Relations, a musical tribute to American Indian Movement political prisoner Leonard Peltier. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
A year after Germany opened its doors to hundreds of thousands of refugees from war-torn Syria, Iraq, and other nations, German Chancellor Angela Merkel suffered an embarrassing defeat in her home district. In the September 4th election in the German state of Mecklenburg-Vorpommern, near the Polish border, the center-left Social Democratic Party finished first with 30% of the vote, followed by the anti-immigrant Alternative for Germany Party with 21%, and Merkel's Christian Democratic Union Party with 19%. The symbolic defeat for Merkel raised questions about her political future after 11 years serving as chancellor. In recent months, Merkel's popularity has fallen to 45%. More than 1 million refugees entered Germany in 2015. Alternative for Germany embraces anti-immigrant, anti-Muslim positions, receiving strong support in older, declining industrial towns. The far-right Nationalist Party has developed a close relationship with the anti-immigrant Pegida movement and its new party, the Popular Party for Freedom and Direct Democracy, which views the influx of immigrants into Germany as the Islamization of the West. Across Asia, so-called special economic zones have fueled export growth and foreign investment in poor nations. But workers are heavily exploited in these zones and blocked from organizing unions. The International Labor Organization has called these zones a symptom of the race to the bottom in the global economy. Outside the capital city of Phnom Penh, a special economic zone there is a sprawling complex of factories financed by Japanese investors. The 44 Japanese companies and other Western businesses at the site include Yamaha, Coca-Cola, and the garment maker Kingmaker Footwear. According to In These Times magazine, the firing of workers for union organizing activities is officially illegal, but it is a common practice in these economic zones. Even Western corporations like Apple and Puma, with corporate codes of conduct that protect labor rights, make little difference. From the beginning, Cambodian officials tried to keep unions out of the economic zones. But that has not stopped a number of organized and wildcat labor actions that have resulted in some improvements in worker pay. However, as worker grievances grow and the corporate and government chokehold on labor organizing tightens, many predict more explosions of frustration from those trapped in the zones. In the historic U.S. Supreme Court decision, Gideon v. Wainwright, the High Court enshrined the constitutional right of indigent defendants to receive legal counsel. However, 53 years after the ruling, The Guardian newspaper reports the rights of indigent defendants is under increasing threat as incarceration rates have risen over 400% and up to 90% of those awaiting adjudication are mired in poverty. In Missouri, where public defenders are paid out of the state budget, Governor Jay Nixon, a Democrat, has repeatedly blocked legislation to cap the workload of public defenders. The governor has also vetoed a bill allocating funds to hire more public defenders, even as workloads have increased over 12% since 2014. In Kentucky, where the state Senate has blocked new funding, public defenders take on an average of 448 cases annually, over 50% above the recommended national standard. In Utah, 62% of misdemeanor offenders have no access to counsel, and at least 35% of public defenders are overloaded with cases. Unlike any other state, Louisiana pays for its indigent defense system primarily through speeding tickets and other locally generated revenue, rather than guaranteeing funds through the budgeting process. The crisis has gotten worse with falling oil prices and new rounds of budget cuts. As a result, indigent defendants are now put on a long waiting list to see a public defender. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
After the full text of the proposed 12-nation Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Deal was released by the Obama administration in November, a broad coalition of opponents, including labor, environmental, and consumer groups, asserted that the actual provisions in the pact were worse than originally feared. They cited an extension of intellectual property rights in the pact that will increase the cost and reduce access to critical life-saving drugs, the offshoring of thousands of U.S. manufacturing jobs to cheaper labor markets, and the flooding of U.S. stores with unsafe and unlabeled imported food. Another divisive element in the TPP, the Investor State Dispute Settlement Regime, or ISDS, allows multinational corporations to challenge local, state, and federal public health, environmental, consumer, and labor laws, as well as court rulings, if a claim is made that they impinge on business profits. These corporations can then demand taxpayer compensation for those lost profits. President Obama, who is strongly backing passage of the TPP, hopes to bring up the trade deal for a vote in the lame duck session of Congress after the national election on November 8th, but before the new Congress and president are sworn into office in January 2017. But as things now stand, that may be difficult, as GOP Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell announced recently that he wouldn't schedule a vote on the TPP agreement this year. Your reporter spoke with Public Citizens International Campaigns Director Melinda St. Louis, who discusses the organizing being done across the U.S. to stop a lame duck session vote on the controversial free trade deal.
At the heart of the TPP are new rights for thousands of corporations to be able to sue the United States government, not in our courts, but before a panel of three corporate lawyers that can award unlimited sums of our taxpayer money, including for the loss of these companies' expected future profits. And all they have to do is try to convince this panel of three corporate lawyers that U.S. policies violate the new rights that the TPP would grant them. And that's just one piece of this massive document. They claim that it's about trade, but in fact, of the 30 chapters of the TPP, almost 6,000 pages, only six chapters deal with traditional trade issues. So we see these massive rights for corporations. We see expanded monopolies for pharmaceutical companies so they can block generic competition and keep drug prices high. We see, you know, further financial deregulation for big banks. And so for that reason, what we've seen is an unprecedented coalition of trade unions, environmental organizations, faith groups, seniors, young people, public health groups that have come together to say that this is not the model that we should be pushing and locking ourselves into for perpetuity, because you can't change these agreements after they're locked in. And so there is massive opposition to this, and it has translated into opposition from both from the presidential candidates on the from the Democratic side and the Republican side. And the elite consensus that's been pushing this free trade model has really crumbled.
Well, Melinda, tell us, what's the status of the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, right now? I think many listeners will have heard stories about how President Obama is still pushing hard for passage in the House and Senate. And I think the latest plan, it sounds like it's running into some obstacles, but the latest plan we were hearing about was that there was going to be an attempt to hold a vote after the presidential election and before the new Congress takes office in January, and that's called the lame duck session.
So the TPP, because it has been so unpopular, and because actually the negotiations took many years longer to complete than what they were hoping, because other countries were actually standing up to some of the most egregious overreach, corporate overreach that was being pushed in the TPP. But because of that, the TPP debate got pushed into the presidential election cycle, which helped those of us who have been wanting to put a spotlight on the secretive agreement for years so that we could actually have a public debate. And so that has started to happen. And what that's meant is that it's become more and more unpopular. And now we're at the situation where no member of Congress wants to touch this, wants to take this kind of controversial vote. So President Obama is pushing very hard and sees the only opportunity in the very unaccountable period after the elections, but before the next Congress starts. So the recently fired or retired members of Congress come back and they have one more chance to vote when they're not accountable to the voters. So that's a dangerous period. And that's the only window that the pro-TPP forces, which are the big companies that have been pushing for this, see as an opportunity. So the good news is that because of all the massive opposition, they do not have the votes to pass the TPP. And this is both Republicans and Democrats are not supporting this, while the Republican leadership collaborated with the White House to get what they call fast-track authority, which means that the TPP will only be voted up or down. There's no amendments. There's no way to fix it. So now activists and what citizens groups are pushing all over the country is to get every member of the House of Representatives on record before the election to say, where do you stand? Will you oppose a vote on this TPP before or after the election? Because we need to hold their feet to the fire while they're campaigning. And many of them are campaigning against the TPP because they know that this is extremely unpopular because it's so harmful to their constituents. You know, everybody will be touched by this. It affects our food safety. It creates more income inequality in the United States, pitting workers in the United States against workers in Vietnam who earn 65 cents an hour, rolling back Wall Street reforms, and as I mentioned, jacking up the cost of medicines and corporate rights that are at the center that allow corporations to be able to sue over our public interest laws. And the TPP would overnight double the number of corporations that could use this extreme mechanism of corporate power against our state laws, our local laws, and our federal laws. And it's extremely dangerous. And for that reason, citizens need to be contacting their member of Congress now and get them on a record now saying they will not support this expansion of corporate power in the TPP.
That was Melinda St. Louis, International Campaigns Director with Public Citizens Global Trade Watch. For more analysis and commentary on growing public opposition to free trade policies, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. More than 30 democracy reform groups across the U.S. are calling on the moderator in the first presidential candidates debate on September 26th, NBC's Lester Holt, to require Democratic nominee Hillary Clinton and Republican Donald Trump to talk about how they plan to make our democracy work for all Americans. The campaign dubbed First Debate Democracy, supported by groups including Common Cause, People for the American Way, MoveOn.org, and Demos, is now collecting petition signatures that will be delivered to Holt, the NBC Nightly News anchor. Those backing the campaign are urging Holt to pose pointed questions to the candidates on the corrupting influence of unlimited and unaccountable money in U.S. politics, a situation made worse by the 2010 Citizens United Supreme Court decision, as well as the attempt in many states to suppress the right to vote in targeted communities of color. Your reporter spoke with Rana Epting, chief of staff for the group Every Voice, who explains the goal of the campaign and why she believes the presidential candidates should discuss their views on the widely held perception across the U.S. that the structure and mechanics of America's democracy are broken and in urgent need of repair and reform.
For anybody who watched the primary presidential debate, you know that the moderators barely scratched the surface when it came to our presidential candidates and where they stand on one of the most important issues to the American people, which is, you know, our democracy and whether our voice matters in our elections and in our government. The moderators never pressed the candidates to really talk about where they stand on how they're going to restore the integrity to this system, this government that's supposed to be of, by, and for the people, but throughout the years, you know, we've gotten further and further away from that. And so the American people are, you know, we believe enough is enough. This campaign season, we really need to press the presidential candidates as we head into the general election about what are they going to do to strengthen our democratic system. And so we're calling on Lester Holt, as you mentioned. He is the first moderator of the debate. The first general election presidential debate is on September 26th, and he has the ability to decide what the issues are that the candidates will be asked about. So we're saying, first, the candidates must debate democracy, and that's the name of the campaign, First Debate Democracy. And yes, over 30 organizations, not just democracy organizations, but organizations like Sierra Club and the NAACP and the Agenda Project and Franciscan Action Network. So folks that don't just focus on democracy, but focus on other issues that matter to the American people are saying, we need our candidates to speak to this, and we need our candidates to lead, to say, this is how we're going to create a better system for all of us. And so far, the campaign, the election season has not challenged the candidates to speak to this. And we've had enough, and we need to prioritize this heading into the debate starting at the end of the month.
Rana, what do public opinion polls tell us about what Americans are thinking as regards to our democratic infrastructure, our democratic system, money in politics, the mechanics of voting, and a lot of other related issues?
Well, although this election season has been pretty partisan and people have picked sides, I would say around the issues of money in politics and our democracy, there is a fair amount of unity. So you've got about 85% of Americans, Democrats, Republicans, independents alike, believe that we need fundamental changes to our campaign finance system or to completely overhaul it. And then you've got 3/4 of Americans believing that our government is corrupt. So we definitely, the vast majority of us agree there's a problem. The difference is when you get to the solutions. So Democrats, Republicans, it's not partisan. We all agree that Citizens United needs to be overturned. There's vast agreement and support for small donor public financing, which is the way where you can fund campaigns or really lift up the voices of regular people. 72% of Americans support small donor public financing. But then where you see the divergence is when you look at the party. So the GOP, really, when you look at, you know, the GOP presidential nominee, and when you look at the rank and file GOP leadership in Congress, that's really where you have the gridlock. No candidate in the presidential primaries on the right had any platform of how they would restore integrity to our democracy. And we know that Senator Mitch McConnell is really holding up any movement in this in the Senate and basically has told rank and file Republicans, you will not vote on any democracy issues, period. So you're seeing gridlock in the places where people hold power and don't want to get rid of it. But in terms of the people and folks listening to this program and your neighbors, there is broad agreement that change is needed.
What kind of answers would you like to see from the candidates if Lester Holt decides to pursue the question of a really big issue in campaign finance? And that's the vow of at least one candidate, Hillary Clinton, to overturn the Citizens United Supreme Court decision, which opened the floodgates wide to unaccountable and unlimited amounts of money flowing into election campaigns.
You know, they're really different on both sides of the aisle. So for Donald Trump, he's not put out a plan to address the so-called rigged system, he says, exists. And so we really want to know, well, how is he going to fix it? Instead of just complaining about it, what are you going to do to restore integrity to it? And so we really have no idea where he stands. Now, on the other side, as far as Hillary Clinton, Hillary has a really robust campaign finance reform plan. You should go to her website and look at it. And in terms of the reform community, we're pretty happy with where she is on paper. We wish that she would talk about more the solutions that she's going to advocate for. We want to hear from her. How is she going to work from Congress to overturn Citizens United? What litmus tests will she use to nominate Supreme Court justices? How will she work with Congress to implement small donor public financing systems at the federal level? How will she support the work, the good work in the states that several campaigns are being run in order to change the way campaigns are financed there? And how will she ensure that voting rights is restored for millions of Americans?
That was Rana Epting, chief of staff for the group Every Voice. Learn more about the First Debate Democracy campaign by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Injustices against Native Americans are the focus of attention today, with the ongoing protest against the Dakota Access Pipeline at the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation in North Dakota. And a decades-old travesty of justice is in the news again, as activists are working to convince President Obama to grant executive clemency to the American Indian Movement's longtime political prisoner, Leonard Peltier, who has been incarcerated for the past 41 years. Peltier was convicted of killing two FBI agents on South Dakota's Pine Ridge Reservation in 1975, during a time of extreme state repression, and sentenced to two life terms. He was convicted despite the fact that there was no evidence tying him to the crime, and his trial was riddled with lies, inconsistencies, withheld exculpatory evidence, and blatant bias toward the indigenous community. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Paul Winter, a Connecticut-based musician and leader of the Paul Winter Consort, which has performed around the world, incorporating sounds of nature, such as whale songs and wolf howls, into their music. Here, Winter talks about why he wrote and produced a musical tribute to Leonard Peltier as a way of engaging more people in the struggle to win his release from prison. Peltier turned 72 on September 12th and is in poor health.
I've played in numerous benefit events over the years. The most noteworthy in recent years was two Septembers ago, the Unity Festival in the Black Hills in South Dakota, which was a two-day gathering and festival to awaken awareness of the movement to get the government to give the Black Hills back to the Indians, and to honor the treaty of 1868. And it was there, really, that playing there that led me to feel that we have to do what we can with music to liberate Leonard Peltier, who has been unjustly incarcerated for 41 years.
You said that event was focused on returning the Black Hills to the Lakota, but was Leonard also a focus?
Leonard, as the preeminent political prisoner of our time, his plight is present in any event that would take place with Native Americans. That summer was the summer of the Seeger Fest in New York, honoring Pete and Toshi Seeger, and a number of us played at Lincoln Center out of doors. And during that event, which was extraordinary, Tina Seeger, the daughter of Toshi and Pete, read a letter from Leonard Peltier to Pete, thanking him for his support over the years. And then when we played, I played our piece Wolf Eyes, at the end of which I often invite the audience to howl. And we invited them to join in a Hallelujah chorus for Toshi and Pete and for a free Leonard Peltier. Peter Yarrow then invited me to come to this gathering a few weeks later in South Dakota. I played Wolf Eyes again, and people howled for Leonard, and someone sent him a video of it, and he sent me a thank you. And I came away for that feeling that somehow music can awaken awareness and soul in deeper ways than other media, all due respect to every form that people have been using to try to make the point that Leonard deserves executive clemency. My feeling was that I wanted to find a great piece of music from the Indian tradition that celebrates the spirit of the entire history of the first peoples of this continent and combine it with Wolf Eyes and the recorded chorus of 2,000 people howling for Leonard in the cathedral, which we recorded last year, and put it forth as a 13-minute EP simply to awaken involvement in this groundswell of voices urging President Obama to pardon Leonard Peltier.
Paul Winter, at the end of Bill Clinton's second term, hopes were high that he might grant executive clemency to Leonard, but that didn't happen.
At the end of Clinton's term, when it was common knowledge that he was reviewing pardons and that Leonard was on the list, the FBI picketed the White House with 200 agents, warning him not to do it. It might have been just all that the FBI had on him. Obama does not have that burden, that baggage, and certainly he's not going to do anything in this direction until after the elections. I don't see that it could have any political repercussions for him down the road. And my point is, this is about something vastly bigger than the pardoning of one political prisoner. It's about atonement for genocide, the atonement for our government's horrible history of genocide against the Indians over the centuries. It would be a tremendous symbolic gesture for Obama to do that.
That was musician and activist Paul Winter. Find a link to his new song, All My Relations, Voices for Leonard, and more information on the campaign to grant Leonard Peltier executive clemency by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show, which is celebrating 25 years on the air in 2016. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Richard Hill, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.